There's your proof. There's his coffin. Let's go.
Hand me the crowbar.
You're not going to open that.
Hand me the crowbar.
I got it. I really don't like this. Stay away from him. He's dangerous.
You're scared, ain't you? You should be.
Look what you did, you little jerk.
I tried to destroy him, but I'm fucked up.
You got that right, punk.
You little turd. I'm gonna punch you, silly.
What do you think?
I think we're dead meat.
So, what were you gonna be when you grew up?
I swear it comes out of your mouth, better be some brilliant fucking Mark Twain shit. It's definitely getting chiseled on your tombstone.
Hey, this is Tom Hart from Dead Till Dark, and you're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. Happy Halloween.
Dropping and rocking till the coffin, you are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show's 4th Annual Halloween Special. Yes, it's Casey Ferguson here, coming at you from the crypt at Motel Ferguson, where if I had just a few favors, I'd ask zombies to eat my neighbors. Granted, it'd be hard to tell them apart. I'm not kidding. The plodding half-dead half-wits that haunt my hallway possess all the mouth-breathing death breath, body rot, and barely functional motor skills necessary to secure parts in The Walking Dead. I mean, if they weren't allergic to work, of course. Anyhow, enough about those shambling slack-jawed suck-offs. That was Dig My Grave by Dead Till Dark kicking off the show, a band which I recently interviewed for my Amherst Island radio show. If you haven't checked that out yet, you'll find it at CaseyFergusonShow.com and CJAI.ca. Boils and ghouls, I have a show for you that is sure to blow the tweeters of you trick-or-treaters. Tom Matthews, star of Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, and The Return of the Living Dead 1 and 2 will be here. September, lead vocalist of the spooktacular band September Morning will be here. I'll also have bone-crunching tunes from Clutch, Failure Anthem, Lincoln Durham, and brand new tracks from Korn, Bisto Blanco, and Gabriel and the Apocalypse, among others. So stay tuned, my fiendish friends. Get on your broom, here comes the boom. This is Sunflower Dead. It's time to get weird on the 4th annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special.
Halloween, and you are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. Happy Halloween, guys! sleep at night. It's a funny thing, regret can make us feel insane. But at the end of the day, at least you feel something. Everybody knows how the story goes, but what's it like when it's crashing down? Everybody knows, everybody knows. You're never gonna kill me.
Star of Werewolf in a Woman's Prison and Killjoy Goes to Hell. You're listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. Happy Halloween.
Don't want pizza. I'll blow down your house.
Creeping and crawling, knocking and rocking, you are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. That was Pisto Blanco, Feed My Frankenstein. Before that, you heard from Failure Anthem, The Ghost Within, and kicking off that set was Sunflower Dead featuring Jonathan Davis of Korn. It's time to get weird. Speaking of weird, dig this article from October 8th. You can find the story at Reuters.com under the headline, Man with Chainsaw Kills Woman, Hurts Another in Shopping Mall in Belarus. A young man armed with a chainsaw and hammer entered a shopping center in Minsk, the capital of Belarus, and killed a woman and wounded another on Saturday evening, a spokesman for city police said. Such violence is rare in Belarus, where President Alexander Lukashenko has ruled with an iron fist since 1994, and it was not immediately clear what the attacker's motive was. When he took out a chainsaw, shoppers first thought it was some kind of game, Alexander Listovsky, the police spokesman, told Reuters. He said the chainsaw and hammer had been hidden in a guitar case which the man was carrying. Then he cut one woman badly with the chainsaw and hit her with a hammer. She died. He also attacked others. At least one wounded woman was rushed to the hospital, he said, and added the assailant was detained after 1 or 2 minutes. First off, my condolences to the family of the deceased. Secondly, what kind of fucking game do people play with a chainsaw and hammer? I mean, I don't expect a shitload of intelligence at the mall, but what the fuck? I dare say, if there is such a game involving a chainsaw and hammer, the mall might not be the best locale to play it. Just another guy prancing around with a chainsaw and hammer at the mall. No big deal. As for carrying the chainsaw in a guitar case, who the fuck was this guy? The dude from Jackal? Lastly, I've definitely threatened to go on a few rampages with a chainsaw, but I'd like to think that it would take a little longer than a minute or two to take me down. Some rampage, you fucking sissy. I'll show you a psycho killer. This is Psycho on the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special.
Lyle from Ghoultown coming at you from the black heart of Texas. You're listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. Have a spooky Halloween.
Filler, you are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. That was Red Tide Rising, The Sound of Voices Screaming, and before that you heard from Psycho with Psycho Killer. My first guest on this episode of the Casey Ferguson Show is actor Tom Matthews. Tom has starred in numerous films, but most of you will know him as Tommy Jarvis from Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, or from his roles in The Return of the Living Dead 1 and 2 respectively as Freddy and Joey. Don't worry, we'll get to that. It is an honor to present to you the first part of my conversation with Tom Matthews on the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. All right, this is Casey Ferguson. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. I got Tom Matthews on the phone. What's going on, Tom?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. First off, congrats on the 30-year anniversary of Friday 6.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It was that long ago, and how people are still responding to it is a little overwhelming and fantastic all at the same time.
Well, I mean, I know that you're appearing at Horrific Film Fest in San Antonio, October 21st to the 23rd, and I mean, it's got to be surreal to see people getting, you know, your autograph tattooed, and you know, just the enthusiasm still on the part of the fans after all these years.
I only know of one person at one convention who got my autograph tattooed on their arm, and that was pretty surreal. I told my acting friends that I had finally arrived. Really fun. It's great to meet everybody though at the conventions, and I didn't do it for a long time because I was busy, and someone, my booker talked me into doing it, and it's just been great talking to everybody and hearing all the different experiences and how they got, and how it inspire them to do certain things in their lives, and it's really a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Now, I've heard a few different stories as to why John Shepard didn't return as Tommy Jarvis, and you know, some say it was because of religious reasons, others say he looked down on the material and felt underappreciated for his work and A New Beginning. Now, I suppose in many ways, at this point, it probably doesn't really fucking matter why he didn't return, but did you hear anything through the grapevine as to what led to you getting a crack at the role?
No, I had no idea that there was anything like that going on. I was just coming off Return of the Living Dead, and I don't know if that had any part playing in me getting Friday the 13th, but it was just, you know, I went in, met Frank Mancuso Jr. over Paramount, and next thing I know, we were off to the race.
You can do it!
Now, according to Crystal Lake Memories, the complete history of Friday the 13th, the original plan for Friday 6 was for Tommy Jarvis to be the new killer, which changed due to the poor reception of Friday 5. If the powers that be had decided to go in that direction, would that character have still appealed to you?
Oh, heck yeah. I was just an actor, a young actor. Look at this job. I just got lucky, and I'm glad it kind of went the way it did. Yeah, I would have done it. Killers are fun characters to play. I've played a few of them in my career, and they're always a lot of fun to play and interesting.
Yeah, certainly, and speaking with other actors, you know, I've heard that playing the villain is often a lot more fun.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. You get a lot more leeway and very creative things you don't normally do in normal life, so it's a lot more fun to play a lot of the time.
Well, now, I heard that there was supposed to be, or at least, you know, there was chatter about a Tommy Jarvis TV show where he was going to play a detective and solve crimes that were sort of in the ilk of Jason Voorhees. Do you remember much about that?
Someone had mentioned that, and I thought, people mention things all the time, but I thought that was probably one of the more interesting concepts out there. And this was years ago, and I haven't heard anything about that since, but if any producers are out there and want to run with that, I think it's a great idea. I'm older now, and Jason's still out there, and, deserves to be put back in the grave.
That's the spirit, Tiger. Well, I just wondered how far they got on that, like if there was ever a script or anything like that.
You know, I never saw a script. I just heard about the idea of it, and that's as far as it went. I think they were, I don't even know who was doing it at the time. I just heard about it. Probably 5 years ago at one of the conventions that someone had heard about it. That was the last of it. But like I said, I think it was one of the more interesting concepts.
Yeah, well, I think like a Friday the 13th show with the right people could very much be a really killer show. What do you think? Does it still have legs?
I think it does. I think with the Walking Dead series being so successful and that whole genre, I also heard 3 years ago the Oscars were going to consider making horror its own category, which is, I thought, was a great idea as well. It hasn't come to fruition yet, but I think it, a lot of people, you know, as you know, started doing horror movies, and that's where they got their start. I think it's a great idea.
Can I get a fucking amen?
I heard the thing to do in Covington, Georgia, where you shot Friday 6 was The Loop. So did you and the cast take part in The Loop, or did you have any good cast parties or anything like that?
Well, we took part in it as far as watching them drive around The Loop in the parking lot. That was the thing to do on Friday and Saturday night at the time.
This town sucks.
Hopefully they've elevated their social gatherings to different things, but
expanded their horizons.
You know, The Loop was probably as big as a football field, and they would just go around in a circle playing their music and stuff, and all the kids would gather out there, and I'm sure they were drinking beer and smoking weed at the same time. Yeah, that was that's what they did.
Well, I suppose, you know, small town, there's not a whole hell of a lot to do.
Yep, not really.
As always, Barber College.
Since Alice Cooper had several songs in the film, and you were in the video for The Man Behind the Mask, did you get to meet him at any kind of promo event or anything?
No, I haven't. I haven't met him, ironically enough. I would love to meet him. Timing of it, or I never saw him on the set, and I never went to where when he was recording anything. But no, I haven't. I haven't met him.
Well, it's a bummer. Well, Alice, if you're listening right now, or Vince Fernier, whatever you want me to call you, give Tom Matthews a call. He'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, 818-523-1234.
I love it. All right, well, let's switch gears here. We'll talk a bit of Return of the Living Dead and some of your other films and whatnot as well.
Okay.
The shirt that you wear in Return of the Living Dead was actually from a clothing company you used to work for, right?
That's right. I did some print work for this clothing company. I thought it was their logo at the time would fit my character perfectly. So I worked, unbeknownst to them, and then I invited the owners out to a screening of Return of the Living Dead when it came out, and they weren't too happy. They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. And I think they were offended by it. Say the truth. They didn't sue anybody, so that was good.
Well, I mean, hell, you're giving them a shout out if, you know, they just realize the merits of what you're doing. I mean, obviously the film's a classic now, whether they got it or not.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, it really, that one in particular has really, like Friday the 13th, Part 6, nobody knew the success and the continued success that these two films have. I mean, whenever you think of going back to Return of the Living Dead, Part 1, whenever you think of a zombie nowadays, you think of them going for the brains, and it was because of Return of the Living Dead. Really set the new trend for pop culture at that time. I was watching a TV show recently, and sure enough, there were zombies, and they wanted brains. Brains! More brains!
Well, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people seem to forget that that's exactly where that came from. That was Return of the Living Dead. That wasn't in Night of the Living Dead or anything else, for that matter.
I mention it, and they're pretty astounded by it, but yeah, that's where it all happened.
Now, I know that you guys used a lot of first takes on Return of the Living Dead, and not a lot of closure reaction shots were filmed. In hindsight, do you think that this was a good thing in just making the film a little different?
Well, I think it happened for a couple of reasons. One of them was Dan had the foresight to have everyone, all the kids, and as many people as he could rehearse for 2 weeks. So there's a lot of overlapping, and which add to the movie, I think. Also, I don't think they had it in the budget because it's a lower budget film. So with the overlapping and the budget restraints, I think that was in part why they shot it that way. I like it. There doesn't have to be a lot of coverage, especially on the couple of scenes where just you see all the characters and they're all pretty much lined up. The one that I'm thinking about, and there's no coverage on it. But yeah, I think low budget movies, there's a certain creativity that comes out of always being in a hurry and having to make snap judged creative decisions in the moment. And I think it translates onto the film at the end of the day. It gives it some kind of unspoken energy that transcends onto the film.
Well, yeah, there's an immediacy there, right?
Exactly.
Now, I know that you weren't in this scene, obviously, but, you know, did you just happen to be in the neighborhood the day that Linnea Quigley did her famous trash dance scene?
You know what? I had the day off, and I made a special trip. on that day, I think I was, had just finished, or was just starting a different scene. I think I had gotten there on my call, and they hadn't finished up the scene, and I just happened to walk in, show up on the set, ready to go to work. I think I had a couple of scenes after that. Yeah, I was able to see that one being shot.
You lucky bastard.
I actually saw the one where she was walking up to the homeless guy in her birthday suit with a merkin.
Yeah, for the listeners that don't know, a merkin is basically a pubic wig.
Yeah, without the hair.
Yeah, that's right. She was bald as a baby down there.
Yeah, I did see that. She was great. She was a real trooper, as everybody was for the most part. She had some issues at the time, but has come around and really, you know, like all of us, we didn't know what Dan was making at the time. And he certainly has come around and is very vocal about how great it is and how he misread it and was very happy to be a part of it.
Well, I mean, it hadn't been done before, right? So, I mean, you kind of got to forgive the cat a little bit because he didn't know what the finished product was going to look like, just like the rest of you, I guess.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah,
Dan really had a vision there.
You don't really know what it's going to look like at the end. You don't have a lot of control over it. You just do the best you can. You show up every day and, you know, give it your all. And wait 6 to 12 months before it comes out. It's a very hard thing to grasp because it's not immediate gratification. Like when you're doing a play, there's an audience and, you know, applause at the end and you go, yeah, that was great. And you're doing film work, it's a longer process and as opposed to television work where you'll do something and 1 or 2 or 3 weeks it'll be on the air. So a movie takes a little bit longer and it's harder to process it as far as what you've done and how it's going to look and just a little bit more complicated. And you forget about, you know, what you were doing a year ago because you're on to the next thing already.
Well, I mean, I come from the music world, so, you know, certainly when you're making a record or something like that, it's very much the same thing because, you know, it's something that you work intensely on for, you know, a period of time, and then, you know, you're usually out on the road or, you know, this or that after that, and yeah, you do forget things, and it's weird because other people are hearing it for the first time and getting excited about it, and you're already kind of like, ah, that was a year ago, you know?
Right. And as you know, in the creative process, when you're totally submersed in something, you're just almost like you're channeling stuff, and you're just really in the moment. So you have the luxury of going back and looking at when you're, or replaying it almost immediately when you're recording stuff. But with film, you have to wait at least one day before you see the dailies, if you're able to see the dailies and you're invited to see the dailies, to see what it looks like or to make adjustments to the character or whatever. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah, true enough. I mean, it's not pieced together just yet.
Right.
Well, now you brought up Clue, and, you know, I mean, Dan O'Bannon himself said at a Q&A for Clue's Film Festival that, you know, he'd been taught in film school to micromanage as a director, and, you know, that led to a lot of tension on set. And I know a lot's been made of this, and, you know, Clue threatening to punch him and all this, but do you think that both were a bit difficult to deal with at the time, or more so brought it out of each other?
Well, Clue was hired at the very last hour, like in the 11th hour. Came in, I think he may have been able to see the last rehearsal that we were doing. Maybe not. I think he maybe just showed up on the set. I really don't remember, but, you know, he was a very serious actor, and I think in his mind's eye, he was considering this role beneath him. So that kind of added to some of the friction. And he also was struggling with his lines, and he had a lot of them because he came on so late, he wasn't able to study them as well as everybody else was. So that creates a particular type of anxiety, even more so than even just acting, because it is anxiety ridden and compound with not knowing your lines or not secure with your lines. It just doubles the stress.
Yeah, he very much strikes me as a guy who likes to be prepared.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, I see him a lot at the conventions. He's really a great guy there.
I know you kept some of your call sheets and eye prosthetics and your script from Return of the Living Dead, but is there anything from any of your movies you wish you could have kept but weren't able to?
Yeah, I did a movie with John Stamos. They had a really nice Harley Davidson I could have had. And some of the cars, you know, that I drove in the past would have been fun. I didn't really keep a lot from Return of the Living Dead. You know, a few personal photographs, pictures that I took at the time, more so on part two, and a bunch from Friday the 13th, part six. And then from there forward, I just started logging everything and kind of keeping the scripts and all my notes from them, and everything has a binder now.
Well, I guess, like you said, you know, you didn't know how it was going to turn out, or, you know, the kind of success it was going to see, so why would you keep a whole ton of shit from it, right?
Right. Now, Brian Peck, who played Scuzz, kept everything he had to get his hands on.
He's got, like, staplers from the office, production office or something.
Memorabilia from all kinds of different movies he was on and movies he wasn't on, just because he liked to collect stuff. Packed with, like a museum.
Yes, yeah, so here's a pen from the production office. I'll sell it to you on eBay, $50.
Yeah.
And you know what the sad thing is, Tom? Somebody probably fucking buy it.
Oh, sure.
Some folks have a strange idea of entertainment.
You know, we haven't really talked much about part two. From what I gather, you didn't have a very good time on the set.
Well, I was confused why they brought it back. I know why they brought it back. You know, I didn't particularly like the script that much. I didn't like the director that much. And I got to know Jimmy Caron a lot better, so that was the highlight of shooting that script. We found out we both have the same birthdays. Maybe that's what our chemistry works so well in part one. But I liked part one because we laughed. The audience and myself laughed at the situations that we got ourselves into. And part two kind of made a joke about it, kind of commented on it, having the Michael Jackson stuff, and all the little gimmicky things that they did. So the only reason why we got brought back in part two is because the Japanese distributors requested that Jimmy Caron and I come back in part two before they put up the money for part two, because when you're making a movie, hopefully you try to get the funding for it before, for just different international markets, and Japan did very well over there, so the only obligation or request was that Jimmy Caron and I come back in part two.
That's certainly a funny thing to have happen. I know anyone that I know that's watched the film is like, well, what the fuck? These guys are back and they're different characters. Like, what the fuck is going on here? But yeah, I do remember you saying in an interview that, you know, it was because the film had done so well in Japan and that these guys wanted you in there. And I mean, I'm glad you made it back for another movie. I just, you know, it's a very strange thing to happen for sure. But if anybody's got a problem with Tom and James Caron being in the second one and then playing different characters, go fuck yourself, because it wasn't their fall. And that's me saying that. That's not Tom. I'm just gonna force my way in here and spout off as I usually do, but fuck you all.
Movie magic. No rhyme or reason. amazing.
Nailed it.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to the 4th annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween special. That was the first part of my interview with actor Tom Matthews. I will have more from that conversation on future episodes of the Casey Ferguson Show. I'll get back to the music in just a minute, but first I want to talk about death metal band names. I have to tell you, I laugh my fucking ass off when I hear the names of some of these heavier bands. Anal Cunt, Dying Fetus. I mean, their names are fucking band something like that. Like, hey mum, I just joined a new band, Anal Cunt. We're playing down at the pub in a few weeks. Would you like me to put you on the guest list? I asked you lunatics to create a fictitious death metal band name or two and send them in. Some of these are pretty fucking comical. Rick Davies sent in Fish Hook Abortions, Chainsaw Evangelist, and Skidmark Saints. Ken Hemlow, Vaginal Blood Farts. Sindo, Death Punch Baby, Voodoo Worms, The Screaming Ponies, Devilish Eggs, The Black Toast. Crystal Bell sent in The Dark Crevices. Lindsay Kuzuk replied to that comment with EU LOL, which obviously wasn't meant to be part of this, but how fucking funny would it be to see some death metal band with all their crazy makeup and satanic shit called EU LOL? Lindsay also threw in Anorexic Nuns. Adam Jacket sent in Seventh Sacrifice, Shit Blisters, Tongue Grinder, Buzzsaw Banshee, and Cavefish Holocaust. Andrew R. Tedford, Steel Wool Enema. Chantel Nicole sent in Pussy Dungeon. Jason Reese from one of this show's kick-ass sponsors, Jaybird Digital Arts, got in on the fun and sent in Sled Dog Afterbirth. Keith Lloyd had a bunch of great ones. Placenta Pus Pie, Phallic Lobotomy, Shark Sandwich, and All You Can Eat Afterbirth Buffet. I'll add a few more to the list here. Bandsaw Circumcision, Maxi Pad Massacre, Anal Leakage, Vegetosis, Cannibal Unicorn, Clitty Litter, and Rabid Wallaby. Motherfucking death metal bands. I do polls like this fairly routinely on the Casey Ferguson Show Facebook page, so if you want to get in on the action, check out facebook.com/thecaseyfergusonshow. Time to get back to the music. I always thought these guys had kind of a strange name for a heavier band. Here's a brand new track from Korn, A Different World, on the 4th annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween special.
Doesn't work anymore. Kill me, that's
Hey, this is Greg from Ash Forest Hi-Fi. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show.
Maurizio Guarini from Goblin. I just wanted to say Happy Halloween. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show.
Struggle is my name. Disgrace is yours.
slicing and dicing, stabbing and slabbing, you are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. From the album Kill the Flaw, that was Seven Dust with Chop. Before that, you heard from Flaw with Bleed Red, and kicking off that set was Korn featuring Corey Taylor of Slipknot with A Different World. I've got some great Halloween prize packs I'm going to be giving out to you maniacs, including autographed photos of Tom Matthews, some Friday the 13th swag, some t-shirts, and all kinds of goodies. Here's how it works. I'm going to give you a code word later on in the show. If you'd like to get in on the prize draws, listen for the code word, then send it to me in a private message to the Casey Ferguson Show Facebook page or in an email to caseyfergusonshow@hotmail.com. Get it? Got it? Good. Less talk, more rock. This is Gabriel and the Apocalypse with Everything Is Red on the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special.
What do you think that you can take from me?
to rattle your bones, you are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. That was September Morning with Eye of the Storm, and before that you heard a brand new track from Gabriel and the Apocalypse, Everything is Red. My next guest is none other than September, lead vocalist of September Morning. Now, September Morning isn't your typical band. September Morning is a transmedia dark culture project created by September and Mark Silvestri. The project centers on the human reaper hybrid September as she navigates the world of the living and the world of the dead. As a half-human, September feels the need to give some human souls a second chance, and thus toys with fate. The story is presented on different media platforms, including music, comic books, and live concert. September Morning have toured with the likes of Marilyn Manson, Mushroom Head, and OTEP, and even had song placement in TNA Wrestling. This is my conversation with September of September Morning on the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. You are listening to the Casey Ferguson Show. I have September from September Morning on the phone. Welcome, September.
Hello, how are you?
I'm just dandy. My phone's giving me a hard time, but other than that, life is good. I'll get a new one of those real soon. Apparently, you've had some phone issues yourself here lately.
Yeah, I really need a new phone. It's funny because it's like with iPhones now, or I don't know if you have a Droid or whatever anybody has out there.
But yeah, I'm a Droid guy.
You get used to your phone. Like, yeah, you want to get a new phone, but I don't know. I have a hard time turning mine in sometimes.
Yeah, I don't like change either. I don't know. I mean, my phone's a piece of garbage, but at the same time, it's my piece of garbage. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. It still works.
Yeah, well, sort of. Half the time.
Yeah, the new iPhones, they're just so big, and I have one that's, like, smaller, and I don't know if I want the bigger one. You know, I don't know if I want to deal. Well, you're on a Droid, so you deal with...
Oh, you gals in size.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just bugging you. All right. Well, now, I'm not going to ask you to explain this project, because every interview I watch with you, people are like, well, tell me about this. Well, I'm sure I covered that in the intro. So instead of talking about what it is, I'd rather you tell me about your character and the Reaper Valkyrie element, because I really like the idea, you know, seeing the most beautiful thing you'll ever see right before you die. I mean, there's something inherently romantic about that notion.
Yeah. Has like a tinge of an element of romanticism to it, and you know, I mean, we all grew up on those kind of romantic movies where the hero like dies in the arms of his beloved or something like that. So, I mean, there's a little bit of that going on, I think, within the storyline. You know, I love romanticism and anything that kind of has that flavor to it. So, definitely wanted to put that into the character a bit. You know, she's interesting because she's kind of an anti-hero when you first meet her. You know, she's like this reaper, so she's, you know, the harbinger of death, but like, you know, you don't really know if she's good or evil or like what her intent is, you know, because again, an evil side always comes with the intent. So that's kind of like how you meet her. And then as the story kind of goes forward and moves forward, you kind of learn more about her and what her intent actually is. And her intent actually changes throughout the storyline too. You know, it develops and it kind of ebbs and flows depending on the bigger picture. So it's an interesting story for sure.
Oh, so it's a very dynamic character for you to portray then.
Yeah, definitely. She starts in one place and she ends up in a totally different place, which is really cool. I like that.
Absolutely. Well, I saw some of your modeling pics and I like that too. I'm glad I got to see those before I die.
Thanks.
You're welcome. All right. I'll be a good boy. I'll play along here. Tell me about your makeup design.
The makeup for September, you know, a lot of it comes from, you know, ancient warrior makeup or like some even American Indian makeup. A lot has to do with, you know, the Japanese and Asian elements of it all. The star over her eye is called the Morning Star, and, you know, it kind of represents life and death. It's like two inverted triangles put together into sort of like a star formation almost. You know, it's all black and white most of the time on her face. You know, again, it's always the dichotomy of life and death with this project, so there's a lot of like extremes from one aspect to another, and you can see that in the styling and the makeup design as well.
Now, was that your idea, or, you know, did you have talks with Mr. Silvestri about that whole design of the
Mark
character?
Mark and I kind of like, we batted things back and forth all the time, you know. A lot of the makeup and the costuming did come from me, and I just kind of threw it at him, and I was like, what do you think, you know? And then he would be like, well, what if you did a little bit of this, and, you know. But the base of the idea did start a lot with me, and what I was comfortable with doing, and, like, what I envisioned for the character, and then he would come in and and just kind of like give me ideas or push my boundaries a little bit. And like, he's just such a great development partner for me, because like, so he'll bring up the whole convex of the situation and be like, okay, well, what if we just did this? Like, what if you took it this way? Totally opposite of what you were thinking. And usually when he does that, it makes me think and like figure out something like kind of in the middle that like works, that really pushes the element of the character more, which is great. You know, you want that in like a creative development partner.
Oh, absolutely. Now, is a new issue of the comic going to come out with each album? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, we want to kind of make it so that every time you see a new issue of the comic book, you have new music that comes along with it. I think that's important, because everything kind of is simultaneous to telling the story. So, you know, we want everything to kind of like integrate into like one storyline. We wanted to make it so that like, if you like the music, that's great. You know, and you don't like comic books and you just want to listen to the music, that's fine. It stands alone, you know? Or if you like comic books and you don't like music, then you just read the comic books, they stand alone. We wanted to do everything that could be standing alone, but it could also fit together to like form this awesome transmedia project. We're doing a good job of it, I think.
In a word, abso-fucking-lutely.
Well, tell me about your new album and the new issue of the comic.
The new album is awesome. The comic book's called The Hand of Fate, and it continues the story from where we left off in the first issue, which was A Murder of Reapers. And it's really, I don't know, it's really cool. The development of the characters kind of comes out more. They're kind of bond within each other. You meet new characters that kind of come in and will probably confuse you a little bit because they're like kind of weird. You meet your antagonist, you get more of a feel of like, you know, who he is and like why he's doing what he's doing. It's more of a development of the story. And then of course all the music kind of coincides with that. And, it is a very emotional roller coaster ride of music. I think that the album is interesting because it has a lot of different flavors, but within that it still kind of stays in the same realm of our sort of particular sound, which is quite different, I'd say, than, you know, the typical normal rock sound that's out there right now. So I think it's, you know, it's definitely very September Morning and very what we want to do.
Well, I very much enjoyed Eye of the Storm. I was watching the video last night, and the video's cool as hell. The song's badass. Really digging it.
Thank you. There's more of that on the album. There's some other different flavors in the album, but it's very cohesive as far as like a soundscape, but there's definitely different flavors in there, so it gives you a lot of different ear candy to listen to.
Well, I mean, you're taking people on a journey, right?
Yeah, because you know, we wanted to do something. If you're soundtracking a comic book, you know, there's all these different scenes and all these different characters, and you know, it's gotta be cohesive, but it's gotta have certain different elements to it, because all these things are so, you know, different in themselves. You know, we wanted to kind of bring that out through the music as well.
Absolutely. Now, you guys toured with Marilyn Manson, and I know you've said about touring with Manson that you learned a lot, especially on that first tour, which leads me to believe that there were probably some nights that were a little smoother than others. So any Spinal Tap-ish moments, mishaps on stage?
You know, with Manson, so awesome, and there wasn't like anything that crazy. I mean, I could tell some crazy stories, but I don't think I should. But
hey, when you think you shouldn't, you should just do it on this show. But I'll leave you alone. I won't pressure you. Yeah. I'm not that guy.
You know, I mean, no, he's awesome. Like, he's really cool. He's brilliant. You know, he's everything that you think he is wrapped up into one big package. And you know, we had a lot of fun. That first tour was just kind of like we got shot out of a cannon. We had no idea what we were doing pretty much, but we liked doing it. It was a lot of fun, and it taught us a lot. The latest tour we did last year was a very short run, just like, you know, a handful of shows, and it was awesome to be out with him again. I love his crew and his people and him and himself, and watching him on stage and you know, he's quite different, I think, now than probably he's ever been. You know, his growth as a performer and an artist, it takes him in different realms, you know, but it's still him, and it's interesting to see like the older version of himself, you know, like kind of come through, and like how he is now comparative to, like, I guess, how he was when he was younger, and how we all, like, envision him in, like, Sweet Dreams videos and things like that. So, you know, it's always interesting to see artists develop like that, and so that's quite interesting for me to, like, to see that. But he's, yeah, he's really cool, and he's funny, and, you know, he's awesome. Yeah, he's Marilyn Manson.
Absolutely. I would actually go as far as to say he's still underrated. I think a lot of people didn't give him the credit that he deserves for, you know, all that he brought to the table.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that people are very, like, people like to be very critical of artists, because especially if you get that big, right, you know, very quickly, like, he kind of, like, when he rose to stardom, he just kind of, like, skyrocketed up there with the craziness, and it was all wrapped around this crazy persona, and like, and you know, he was very, very smart about it, and people remember that, so, and he's shock rock, so they're just like, well, you've got to top it, but I think, you know, and it's always like, what are you going to do next, and da, 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 and like, it's like, and if you don't, like, push it over the edge every single time, people kind of like, are like, oh, this sucks, or, you know, and like, and you really look at the development of his character and his music, and he does it because he does push limits. Like, he did an album that was just totally, I forgot which one, it was one with, when he did that Rachel Evan Wood, video and like stuff like that. Like, I mean, that album, that whole heart shaped whatever it was, that album.
Oh, the heart shaped glasses, sir?
The heart shaped glasses out. Yeah, that album was like totally different than anything he had ever done. And people are like, he's not pushing the envelope, but I'm like, musically, like, if you listen to his music, like, he's constantly pushing the envelope. Whether you like it or you don't, he's trying different shit all the time, you know? He's
absolutely.
He's not just writing the same song over and over and over, Nickelback style. Like, he's not doing that, you know? Like, just to sell records. He's sonically reinventing himself constantly, you know? And I think that, you know, that's being a real artist. That's what it's all about, and he's lucky that he can do that. A lot of times nowadays, it's like, everybody's like, just do what your, you know, your safety net is, and like, what sells, and like, pick up all the things in active rock that you know will sell a record, and write a record like that, and put it out there, and get on radio, and you're golden. Like, that's what artists think nowadays, which is really sad, and he doesn't think that way. He thinks like, what can I do to experiment? What can I do to, like, push the boundaries? He doesn't listen to anybody else and be like, oh, I have to be like that. Like, there's no fucking way he does that, you know? It's like, he is his own artist, and that's what's so cool about him.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, big moment was that same record that you're talking about, you know, for me, was Putting Holes in Happiness.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, going acoustic, and I just thought, you know what, I always kind of wondered what, you know, acoustic Manson would sound like, and, I mean, it was great, it was phenomenal, it was, as far as I'm
right.
concerned, that song is, you know, one of his best.
Yeah, and I love the soundtrack song he did for the Salem series, like, the Witch Drum song, like, is fucking phenomenal. I think that's, it's brilliant. Like, I just think that, you know, he wouldn't have written that how many years ago, you know, but he does now because he can, and he wants to sonically push himself. And I just think that that's something that's lost a little bit on my generation of artists, you know, but I think that has a lot to do with the industry itself, because when you don't have a lot of money in the industry, there's not a lot of risk. We're living in a day and age that rock is very particular with its budget and finance, and, you know, you have to, like, find the people that believe in your risk.
And, oh, absolutely.
And hopefully you can find those people, and you can really take a risk. So.
Well, I mean, the way I see it, no risk, no reward. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Early on, you worked with Dave Ray Vogelby, who's worked with everyone from, you know, Skinny Puppy to Nine Inch Nails, Motley Crue, David Bowie.
Dave! I mean,
yeah, how was that?
Dave's crazy, man.
I like him already. A man after my own heart.
Oh, my God. We had so much fun. I don't even remember that weekend, but it was a lot of
fun. One of those.
I mean, it was one of those weekends that I spent lying on the drum room floor of staring at the ceiling, go, how did I get here? Dave's hilarious. He's really fun to mix with. We had a lot of fun mixing that. We did, like, a bunch of demo songs that we put together ourselves. But before we were on Sumerian or anything, we got this deal through a German label that wanted to release something, but of course we didn't really have anything. We had a bunch of demos and we produced them ourselves, and they're like, no, we love those, let's put those out. And we're like, okay. So I called up Babe and I was like, yo, because he had worked with my friends from the Birthday Master.
Okay, I've had them on the show, actually.
Yeah, Michael. Yeah, Mike is, Rainbow is a good friend of mine. And so he suggested that I get Dave to mix the demos or whatever. And so I was like, I call him up and he's like, yeah, come up to Vancouver, it'll be fun. So I go up there and it's like me and my guitarist and we're up there mixing with him and it's just a lot of fun. Like I ate a brownie at one point and I was on the floor of the drum room for like 9 hours.
Space Mountain.
What's that?
Space Mountain, I call that.
Oh my God, I couldn't move. And like his assistant came into the room and he's like, are you okay? And I was like, dude, I can't move right now. I was like, I have to go to the bathroom, but I can't move.
Yeah, do you got a bucket handy?
Yeah, it was like that, remember that in the Wolf of Wall Street, like the Quaaludes? Like,
oh, yeah.
It was like, that's literally me. I was like crawling to the bathroom. I remember Dave came out of the studio and he's like, you want to come in and like listen to this mix? And I was like, I do, but I don't think I can get in there. You're going to have to like drag me.
That's guerrilla record making right there.
Oh my God. I was like, do not feed me your food anymore, Dave. So anyway, but it was cool.
Yeah, I can't do the body stone either. I remember the last time I got into that, I was like checking my heart to see if I was still alive. I'm like, I'm never doing this again.
I love it. I just didn't know how strong it was going to be because I've eaten a brownie before, but like I didn't even eat that much. But the stuff in Vancouver, I don't know if you've ever smoked anything up there. Like,
pretty wild strains out that way.
Oh my God, and I'm not like I don't like do that stuff very often at all or anything like that. Like I'm not a I'm pretty clean and sober, but
no, I'm sorry to hear that.
I really didn't realize, it would take me for such a ride. And this was a couple years ago, and I was just like, wow, yeah, no.
Well, I'm guessing that your experience with Howard Benson was a little different.
Oh, God, yeah. I wish I could have given Howard a brownie. That would have been fun. Me and Howard lying on the drum room floor going, what did you do to me, Emily? his guys are fun, though, too. He has a couple, Johnny and Lenny work with him. They're his programmers. We were up all night working on stuff, every day for a while there. It was really fun. So, different experience, but lots of fun. Dave's awesome, though. He's a really great mixer, and he's a lot of fun to be around.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. That was my conversation with September of the band and Transmedia Dark Culture Project, September Morning. For all things September Morning, check out septembermorning.com. Which brings me to the code word for you to enter the draw for a killer Halloween prize pack, featuring an autographed picture of Tom Matthews, some Friday the 13th swag, a horror t-shirt, and more. Your code word is morning. That's morning with a U, as in the band's name September Morning, or I don't see myself mourning the loss of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. Here's another track from September Morning. This is their version of Benny King's Stand By Me, right here on the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special.
Yeah. this is Umpo Quaho of Saw 3. You are now listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. What the?
Deeply departed.
like a chainsaw, I'm bringing a little yeehaw. You are listening to the 4th Annual Casey Ferguson Show Halloween Special. That was Clutch, Decapitation Blues. Before that, you heard from Conduit with Year of the Dead, which couldn't be any more fitting with all the musician deaths we've had this year. And kicking off that set was September Morning with their rendition of Benny King's Stand By Me. Well, lunatics, I'm crawling to the finish line on this one. You might not be able to tell from my voice because I always sound a little sick and twisted, but I'm sicker than a Max Hardcore movie right now. I am all fucked up on Robitussin, so it's up to you to leave no drink undrunk. Undrank? Undrunken? Well, it's clearly time for me to go. Thank you to my guests, Tom Matthews in September from September Morning. Thank you to the bands and their reps for sending me some spooktacular tunes to play for you on this year Halloween special. Thank you to my sponsors, and of course, thank you for listening. Lincoln Durham will play us out with a track called The Creeper. Remember, a man who fears suffering is already suffering from what he fears. Happy Halloween, everyone. This is Casey Ferguson, over and out.
Always ready to betray.